Now, if you could ask God one question and know you'd get an answer, what would it be? I mean, many of you know that's how the Christianity Explored course starts. It's actually a great start if you think about it. First night, you gather together, people are going to explore, check out this whole Christian faith thing. What's the big question for you? Let's get it on the table. And you realise if you've read through any of the gospel accounts in the New Testament that actually time and again, people come across Jesus and they get their opportunity to ask their one question. And it happens again tonight in the incident, doesn't it? The expert of the law meets Jesus and he stands up and he says, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" That's his big question. It's a pretty good big question, isn't it? The thing that's quite striking, of course, is you wish as you read on that Jesus had done the Christianity Explored course himself. Because you get a little bit puzzled. He asks, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And we know the answer has nothing to do with doing. It's actually to do with believing and receiving and so on. But Jesus says, "Do this and you'll live. Go and do likewise." And you wonder what he's playing at. Until you realise, of course, that questions aren't just made up of the words that come out. That there can sometimes be questions behind the question. What must I do to inherit eternal life? It is a great seeker's question, isn't it? Someone who's saying, there's some eternal life out there, and how do I get to it? Actually, it could also be a great curiosity question. I'm not sure I understand much about it, but if there is anything in this God business, how do I get a piece of it? That's not a bad insurance policy question to ask. And in this case, we discover it's neither the great seeker's question nor the curiosity question, because look at verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. It's just a trick question. He's not interested in the answer to do anything about it. He's asking the question to try and expose Jesus, put him down, get him in an awkward position. The thing is, you discover he's not the only one in the Gospels who do it. When people do that, Jesus seems to be able to kind of read their mind as it happens. He knows the difference between a person who is serious but slow and is immensely patient at answering them, and the one who's just trying it on. Do that with Jesus, and you tend to get either silence, no reply, or more than you bargained for. In this case, I think it's more than he bargained for. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And by the way, when it says an expert in the law, it's meaning the law of God, not the law of the land. It's meaning the law, the Jewish Bible, what we would call our Old Testament. He's more an expert theologian than he is an expert barrister. "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus does what we'd all love to be able to do come exam time. Answer a question with a question. See verse 26, "What's written in the law?" I mean, you're the expert. How do you read it? Well, he answered, "To love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." And you realize, don't you, that here's the man coming with the trick question to test to Jesus, and he discovers that the expert theologian is now reciting Sunday school lesson number one, as if he hadn't realized that was the answer in the first place. And Jesus goes on, doesn't he? "You've answered correctly," Jesus replied. Sort of rather patronizing, "Well done." Pat him on the head. "Now just get on and do it. Do this and you'll live." Well, if you're in the expert's shoes, you can't afford to stop there, can you? He wanted to justify himself, which is what we're all tempted to do most of the time, isn't it? You know, these commandments are easy enough to recite, but impossible to live if you take them at face value. So instead of saying, "I can't," he tries to make them manageable. He asks Jesus, "Who is my neighbor? Where do I draw the line? Jesus, I want to make sure my checklist is accurate. So how exactly do you define neighbour? Really, the question is, who is not my neighbour? Who don't I have to bother about? It's very easy to cover moral weakness by posing intellectual questions, isn't it? And actually, at the time, there was something of a debate that went on, an almost nationalistic one, where a strand of Jewish religious thought assumed neighbour had to be of your own blood. So, you see, if you weren't a fellow Jew, you couldn't possibly be a neighbour. Well, Jesus, is that what you mean by neighbour? Well, you see, as the expert in the law climbs on his intellectual high horse, Jesus says, let me tell you a story. And we move from the big question to the familiar story. Because it is familiar, isn't it? It's probably the best known of all of Jesus' story. That is a very well-worn path from Jerusalem to Jericho. And for nearly all of us here this evening, I'm imagining the surprises have gone. The man who goes down that road, Mr. Isaacson, and gets mugged and done over and left for dead. The religious people who walk by on the other side, they're not having anything to do with it. And the Good Samaritan of all people. The kind of stereotype enemy stops and looks after him and takes care of him. And, you know, if the shocks and surprises have gone, we can still imagine the scene, can't we? You know, it may sort of feel a bit strange. We'd just dial 999, but there'd be no one who'd answer that call then. There was no NHS, no ambulance. There are bits of the world today that would know exactly what it felt like. Someone was telling me this week about country in Africa, a hospital there, you want emergency treatment, you have to pay for it. So one of the first things someone does is goes outside to check, are you worth treating? If there's no chance of survival, well, we won't go on with it. We're in that kind of a setup more than anything else. And if the police had the resources to investigate, you know, they'd have put their sort of blue do not cross lines up. They'd have looked around. CSI, silent witness, would have done their stuff, brought it back to the lab and reported in on what they'd found. Well, they'd have been able to tell the detective inspector there were a few footprints around on the road, a number so clear we can even identify the make of the shoes. We know what type of trainers they were. Here they were. You know, it's the what's yours is mine, I'll take it brand. Almost certainly those belong to the robbers. Unfortunately, they're very common shoes, what's yours is mine, I'll take it. You know, it happens all over the world, all over the time, doesn't it? Governments, dictators take it from their own people. Reading an article the other day about how deep the corruption was in is in South Africa and how much of a battle the new government's got to try and root it out. Multinationals and the taxes they pay or don't pay. Internet scams, expense fiddlers, fare dodgers, they all wear the same shoes. What's yours is mine, I'll take it. I don't know if you know anyone who wears shoes like that. Then there are other shoes that forensics have been able to identify from the footprints, and they're a subtly different make. See, these ones, these are what's mine is mine, and I'll keep it. And from what Mr. Isaacson in his hospital bed as he recovers has been saying, they've discovered that one of the footprints, set of footprints, belonged to a priest, the other to a Levite, very religious men, which is why they're sandals. and the prince just goes straight past the scene on the other side. What's mine is mine, I'll keep it. We don't know what motivated them to hurry past. Could have been fear of a trap. It's a pretty well-known scam. You know, one of the gang lies down in the road as if he's been a victim and left injured there. You stop and bend over him, and then the rest of them pounce on you. It could be compassion fatigue. There's only so much you can do, isn't it? People get overstretched. The same beggar in front of the same supermarket day after day after day. could just have been priorities. You know, an important service at the cathedral. Actually, in that culture, if it were a corpse, and he certainly did a pretty good imitation of a corpse, and the priest had touched it, he would have been ceremonially unclean. He wouldn't have been able to do anything for the next week. You know, he might have ticked all the religious boxes. Rather frightening to think you can do that and not tick the godly one. The rector had an important Bible study to lead. Who knows? We can only guess at the motives, but what's mine is mine. I'll keep it. And they're a very popular brand of shoe, aren't they? It's a wonderful idea, but not now, not here, not in my backyard. Yeah, we do it all the time. Look, I teach children all week. Don't ask me to teach them on Sunday as well. Charity, it begins at home. You never know where it leads once you get involved. Once you start, you can never get out. What's mine is mine. I'll keep it. Some more footprints, though. These are very different shoes, these ones. These ones, their make is, what's mine is yours. I'll share it. They belong to the one person we've been able to identify. And remarkably, of all people, he was a Samaritan. A wrong'un. Stopped to help his traditional enemy, a man who might have spent his life sneering at and abusing him. And yet still this Samaritan says, what's mine is yours. I'll share it. Risk the dangers of stopping on that road. Had his first aid kit with him, the bandages, the oil, the wine, walked himself so that the man could have an ambulance, well, a donkey, paid the hospital bill, a month's wages. To the inn, there's no hospital. Gave his time, put himself out at risk, even promised to pay any extras when he looks in on his way back. For a Samaritan, certainly for the Jewish stereotype of a Samaritan, it was totally out of character to act like that. But whatever, he was true to the brand name. What's mine is yours. I'll share it. The big question, the familiar story. Yeah, and just as you think we're stopping there, no, don't miss it. The sting in the tail. The sting in the tail. Remember the question that had prompted the story in the first place? Who is my neighbor? Do you see the twist in this question when we get to verse 36? Who is my neighbor, he asks. He hears the story, and here's how Jesus rounds it off. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? Who is my neighbor? Now, which one was a neighbor? He's gone from who is your neighbor to who are you neighbor to. It's gone from theory to practice. It's gone from neighbor as a character that needs a category that needs defining and having boundaries put on it to neighbor as an endless series of relationships to be entered into. Which of these three? And the expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. You almost feel as if he can't bring himself to say the word Samaritan. But he's got the point. The limits are gone. This is mercy that steps across all the boundaries. As if Jesus' story had stepped into fantasy when the Samaritan appeared. It crosses ethnic boundaries. It's mercy for the foreigner. It crosses religious boundaries. It's as if it's the Muslim who stops and helps. It's nearly 25 years ago now. I was living out the East End in Mile End. I used to cycle in to work in the city. And I remember one day cycling in and I got on the back of my bike a case and a plastic bag, which amongst other things had my wallet in it. And somewhere on the journey, the plastic bag slipped out. And I got there, and you know, it's so annoying when you lose a wallet and all the things you've got to do. And then my wife rang me, and she said a man had turned up on the doorstep. And he'd got my wallet. He'd found the address. He'd gone from Whitechapel out to Mile End to the address. When he saw Claire there, he refused to give her the wallet because her name wasn't in it, and he wanted to make absolutely sure he was giving the wallet to the person whom it belonged to. But he would come back at the end of the day. So I got home early and went across to him, and he gave me this wallet. I thought, here is the Bengali Muslim loving the Christian minister. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robber? The one who had mercy. Then you see how the incident ends, verse 37? Go and do likewise. And you say, that's it? I mean, that's all there is to it? What must I do to inherit eternal life? Love your neighbor? And you're relieved, and you think, well, that's kind of Boy Scout religion, isn't it? You know, be nice to people, get thy badge, I'm in. If you're thinking that way, let me say, I've had longer to think about it than you probably have. And I'm hearing that, and I'm reeling. To me, that punchline is awful. I think I've been following the logic as it's gone. What must I do to inherit eternal life? Love your neighbor. Who is my neighbor? Well, to be neighborly is to be like the one who had mercy. Go and do likewise. And I'm stuffed. I've had it. I don't have mercy like that. I haven't. I can't. Sure, I can be nice to people, the right people, but not like this. See, this isn't every now and then nice. This is not children in need time nice. This is 24/7 mercy person. This is going out of my way to have mercy person. This is when it's inconvenient and I don't have the time mercy person. I get to this punchline and I think, there's a whole raft of the law, and I'm just facing love your neighbor, and I can't pull that off. What hope of eternal life? I mean, I can't go striding up to God as if I'm just the ticket and demand my rights. If you could ask God one question, and we've had that, and I'm wanting to put my hand up and say, excuse me, could I have a second question, please? Because I want to ask another one now. And my follow-up question is going to be this. What kind of God are you? Because you see, I need God to be, I don't know how you say this in a Jewish culture, but I need God to be a good Samaritan God. The kind of mercy person this Samaritan was, God. God to be the kind of person who'd have mercy on someone who's been a stranger to him, an enemy even. To bother with the kind of human you have to invest massively in to sort out the mess and put back on their feet before ever they do anything. Go and do likewise. If that's all there is, I'm a goner. And are you really any better off? He wanted to justify himself. I want to justify myself. I can't. What must I do? You see, if I keep asking that question, what must I do? What must I, if I start there, this story tells me I need to look somewhere else. The expert, if he'd been humbled by the end, is left looking for the God he needs. Our last song is a Christian song. It says we have a good Samaritan God, a love the undeserving God, which is why it begins, thank you for saving me. What can I say? We've a recklessly loving God. You shed your blood for me. What can I say? A costly loving God. You took my sin and shame, a sinner called by name.